So for me, it was like a shock to see a woman like that. It was like Sigourney was looking at me and saying, Aleni, wake up. You can be whoever you wanted to be. You don't need to be a housewife. You don't need to be a teacher. You can be whoever you wanted to be. And from that day on...
But this is also a story. It's a love story. And people will learn some relationship advice through this. It's a story about how to live a happy and fulfilling life.
Love, love, love. Fertile soil for a unique story to flourish. A young Aleni resetting a paradigm in her mind to take a path that required true courage.
Every time we fight with reality, we lose. But how you react to the reality is something that you can choose. Your thoughts have different energies. Your thoughts can really be thoughts that are life-giving. But some thoughts can be life-destroying. We are so much more than what we think we are. We can have a fantastic and happy life, but what we are really here for is...
Greetings, I'm Ashley Samuels McKenzie.
And I'm Charles Parkinson.
And welcome to How I Became,
where we unveil the unscripted journeys of inspirational figures.
If you enjoy the show, could you do one thing? Subscribe. Wherever you are, just click the subscribe or follow button. That simple act can help us grow the podcast in a big way. And we need your support to do it. And if you really want to help play a part in our growth, rate us on Spotify or leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It would mean the world. Thank you. This episode is brought to you by Uber, shaping the future for consumers as they go anywhere and get anything. Advertising on Uber connects brands with hundreds of millions of people using Uber around the world in the moments that move them most. To learn more about what we can do for your brand, visit uber.com/advertising.
Hello, I am Aleni Santos and this is How I Became. I am Chief Brand Officer and Chief Equity, Diversity and Inclusion Officer at Unilever.
Raised in a family home where thinking outside the box was encouraged in her youth. With a parent who was a physicist, she has a knack for finding the real mechanics of truth. She was the first saleswoman in Unilever, Sao Paulo, Brazil. Working within a male and slightly hostile environment meant she faced her first few years in a battle uphill. Understanding your environment and finding common ground are two ways to fit in with your peers. And truth be told, those principles have surely paid off for her over the years. In this fast-paced world, today we'll tell her story so everyone can sit back and take a breather. Introducing Aleni Santos, Chief Brand Officer and Equity, Diversity and Inclusion Officer at Unilever.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you.
There we go. That's your life in a poem. And we are going to tell the story today of how you became Chief Brand Officer and Chief Equity, Diversity and Inclusion Officer at Unilever, which is a huge organization, a huge achievement to get to that role. It's an organization that probably most people watching and listening now have some Unilever products in their home. It's a FTSE 100 company. It has products in over 190 countries, which is almost all of them. And so we'll hear a bit about Unilever in a moment. But this is also a story. It's a love story. It's a love story in many ways. And people will learn some relationship advice through this. It's a story about how to live a happy and fulfilling life, which you've got some great lessons on. And you just... That's how you seem to live your life too. So I think people can learn from that, how to reach the highest level and be successful and be happy and fulfilled doing it. Metaphysics, we're going to talk about. People can learn about metaphysics. And advice on how to make a positive impact in this world, in your organization, how to make change, which is what you do. And amongst, people didn't always like it. And you've got some great stories about how to get people on board, or how to prove your case to people who might not like your positive ideas. So that's all to come. Before that, some quick fire questions.
Oh. First one.
Yeah.
What is your favorite business, leadership, or management book?
Honestly, I've never been a big fan of businesses books. All the inspiration that I get for what I do and the way I lead is coming from other kind of leaders, not business leaders. I think that it's very much because I believe that we should be living in a new paradigm of leadership. So big thinkers, philosophers, poets, painters, these are the kind of books and leaders that really inspired me.
Is there a particular one that inspires you, leader or inspirational
person? For different things, different people. So the usual suspects, the great peacemakers in the world are the ones that I always try to understand. Everybody who wins a Nobel Prize of Peace is someone that I'm very interested in, because I think it is probably someone that shares the same values as I do in terms of making this world a more inclusive world. So this is a series of leaders that I've been following. The latest one was Malala, who I had the pleasure to meet and to share some thoughts.
Amazing. I love that. And great advice. Throw out the business books. Look at people who changed the world and learn from them.
Next one. Do you have a favorite podcast at the moment?
Yes, I do. And it's called How I Became.
See what you did there.
We did not ask you to say that. You are the second person who said it, and we love it.
We love it.
I love that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Next question. Do you have a favorite artist at the moment that you listen to on Spotify?
I have different phases, different artists, different moments. Mm-hmm. There was a phase in my life that I was obsessed about U2. Mm-hmm. And it was like every song of U2 was meaningful to the moment that I was living. And so I was obsessed about U2. And Unilever was doing a big course in Ireland about Greek gods and how we could transfer the stereotypes or this kind of profiles of the gods into brands, something interesting like that. Wow. And I said, well, I would love to go, but my plot was really to go to Ireland to meet Bonovox. That was my my intention. And the guy who was organizing this course actually was a friend of Bonovox, and I knew that. So that's why I said, well, maybe there is a chance. Mm. So the guy said to me, you should come and you should stay in his hotel, because many times he's there on Wednesdays. So maybe you have the lucky moment of meeting him in the hall of the hotel. And I was there, but unfortunately he didn't show up. But there was a chance of going back to Ireland to the same course once more. And the next time I said, now you have to prepare something for me because, I have to meet Bonovox. And indeed he did. He prepared a special dinner where I had the opportunity to meet my idol, to talk to him, to understand, what was behind his songs. Of course, I could reconnect with some of my, memories of the phases that I was going through and listening to his music. And of course, many people had the same kind of connection with U2 songs and many other songs. But it was a magical moment. So it was really a dream coming true. Yeah, such an idol for me, and having the opportunity to meet him, to exchange some ideas. So I still have and cherish some of the albums that he gave to me with loving words. And I'm still cheering for them. I didn't watch them in the new Sphere in LA, but I will.
You will, I'm sure. Yes. Sounds exciting.
Yeah.
So it's Saturday evening.
Yes.
You open up your Uber Eats app. What restaurant are you ordering from in London?
I have the great pleasure of having three chefs at home. My husband cooks divinely. One of my sons is a chef, and the other son is not yet a chef, but he knows how to cook extremely well. So our Uber Eats is our kitchen, actually. We eat extremely well at home in a very healthy way, there's a variety of foods. We love exploring different cultures, especially when we are traveling. There's always a bag that comes with lots of different condiments, spices, different things, so that we can produce different things at home. And my job when they are cooking is to organize the most beautiful table settings. Mm-hmm. And my friends can testify for that. I love having a beautiful table, enjoying the meal with friends in a beautiful environment.
Excellent. Okay. Yeah. That's a bit about you there. Now we go back.
Yes.
To where it all begins.
Okay.
Your parents sound like incredible people.
Yes.
And they had a major influence on your life.
Yes.
And that really helps us understand what's sort of driven you into the life you've lived and the values that you have. So I want you to talk about, how did they define success for you and your two brothers when you were younger? Did they sit you down and say, okay, you must get a great job and maybe be a doctor or an accountant or a lawyer and go on a great path? Was that success? Was that the advice?
No, not at all. Not at all. I think that that's also not the norm in the Brazilian culture where I grew up. And actually, I think that the conversations were always very organic. So we never had kind of formality of conversations about career or about the future like this. Everything was much more natural, organic. And I think that for my mom and my father, I think that they really wanted us to have good values and to have a very fulfilling life. We had the most magical childhood. Our childhood was incredible in so many ways. So we were very happy kids. I have two brothers, and we are always surrounded by cousins and friends, and the house was always full and always very noisy, and there was food for everyone, and there was there are lots of different games and different things that we were doing. So I think that we grew up with a lot of freedom. I think that freedom maybe is a good word to define the way I grew up. There has never been in our home any conversation about you should think about this, you should be like that, you should study this. The three of us, we were very free to choose whatever we wanted to be.
Were they teaching you what was important in life at that stage? And what was that?
I'm coming from a family that is very respectful for the differences that exist in the world. And so treating everybody with a lot of respect, it doesn't matter who they are, what title that they carry, how much money they have in the bank, has always been something super important. It's much more about, how can we build a more inclusive world, a world where people feel that they belong, a world that is more creative, that is more open to new ideas. So creativity was one of the greatest focus of my education. So my parents were always trying to push us as much as they could for us to really exercise the muscles of creativity. And that was the sort of applaud that we received from them when we were being very creative and breaking the molds and having fun. Yeah, so we always had a lot of fun. I think that these are some of the elements that we had. It was a family full of love. I think love is something super important. And love was probably the key thing that helped me and my brothers to grow up with such strong sense of self-confidence and this sense of belonging as well. So having the relationship of my father and my mother and how much love they had to each other, that was a huge inspiration, and I'm so glad that I can continue the same cadence of love with my husband and my family.
And I think that gives, for everybody who knows what you've gone on to achieve, it gives a lot of context as to why maybe. We've got a question about your father.
Yes,
your father was very interesting.
Yeah.
Physicist.
Yes.
And a very specific physicist.
Yes.
In quite a fascinating area. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, my father is a very special guy, very clever, extremely clever, and he has always been very curious about energies and alternative sources of energies. Nature was something that was very much part of our lives as well, especially living in Brazil. Mm. So he was always very interested to find different ways to source energy without harming the planet. So we grew up in a house that he projected, and when he projected that house, he projected in such a way that everything was sourced by the energy was sourced by the sun. So at that time was quite a breakthrough. Nobody had anything like that. He had lots of patents in Brazil because nobody had thought about that at that time. So everything was, you know, sourced by the sun. And we were, you know, of course, growing up in that house, of course, our consciousness about the planet, our consciousness about how we should live our lives was very much guided about this sense of energy and how can we manage energy in a way that is helpful for the planet. And later on in my life, study metaphysics, how can we manage energy when it comes to ourselves.
Now you have a moment when you are younger
that
changes your life. Changes your perspective on the world, on the perspective on what the moving image can do to influence people, which is so related to what you do today. And you say that you would not be where you are today had this not happened.
That's true.
What are we talking about? So just tell us the story.
Okay. Yeah. So again, although I was a very confident girl, very independent and very happy, there was a moment that things got a little bit shaky. And there was a movie that was coming to Brazil from Hollywood. And this movie was a movie from Ridley Scott called Alien.
Ah, many people will know the film
Yes. But it was a very iconic film. And when it landed in Brazil at first, the translator for the film got the name of the film wrongly.
Oh, no.
And instead of calling it Alien, he called it Alini. So I don't know if it was the translator or the printer, because everything was printed at that time. So there was no internet at that time. But in the newspapers, when they launched the film, the name of the film was Alini, not Alien.
Which is your name.
Which is my name.
And does it have a meaning in Portuguese?
No, there's nothing in specific.
Okay.
No, it was, I think they just mixed up the letters because it's the same letters.
Wow.
But anyways, it became Alini. Yeah, so this monster became Alini. And out of the sudden at school, everybody was bullying me and everybody said, Alini the monster, Alini this, Alini that. Alini is coming from another planet. And I started to suffer from that. I said, wow, you know. And I came to my mom and my mom said, don't get troubled about this, yeah? Just go to the movies and watch this bloody film and see what it is.
How long had passed by this point? How long had the movie been going out?
And not much. Okay. Maybe a month, 2 months.
Oh, gosh.
Yes.
That is quite a long time.
And
you hadn't seen the film yet. And everyone's saying you're this monster and you're
exactly,
like, what on earth is
exactly,
this?
Exactly.
Wow.
And so I went to the movies and I watched this film and
I can just picture you there just like right, let's see what this is all about. Here we go.
Exactly.
Show me.
Exactly. Yes.
Did you go with anybody or
I think I went with my mum, but I don't remember to be honest.
Okay.
Because the film and the story was so dramatic for me and I had such an impact in my life, so that is the only thing that I could concentrate. So I remember seeing the film and I remember seeing Sigourney Weaver and for me that was the striking moment, because when I saw Sigourney Weaver playing Sergeant Ripley, which was this strong woman who was taking the leadership of the spaceship, she was killing all the monsters, she was the one who was really taking the lead. For me, it was actually the first time that I was seeing a woman like that.
Wow.
Because the references that I had, were very positive. But, you know, the women in my family, they were either teachers or housewives. Nobody had this kind of a more evident leadership role like I was seeing for the first time from Sigourney Weaver. And so for me, it was like a shock to see a woman like that. And for me, it was everything was paralyzed. And it was like Sigourney was looking at me and say, Alini, wake up. You can be whoever you wanted to be. You don't need to be a housewife. You don't need to be a teacher. You can be whoever you wanted to be. And it was like a parallel reality, she talking to me. And of course, I knew it was just a movie, but it was really, really a wake-up call. And from that day on, I changed something here, and I reset my paradigm about what I wanted to be in my life. And although I didn't have any clarity at the moment, I knew that I was going to aim much higher than just being like my mom or my aunties. I wanted to be something else, and I wanted to be something that would expand my notions of what a woman could be.
Wow, so powerful. And how old were you at this stage?
I was young. Wow, that's a good question, because maybe we can do the calculations. 4 years ago, was it 4 years ago? We had a lunch in Cannes, and Ridley Scott invited me to have lunch with him and with many creatives to celebrate 40 years of Alien.
Did he know your story?
He does know my story. He does know the story. He watched my TED talk about this.
Yes.
That's why we connected. He knows that after that, there are some other implications as well I can talk about, which is the creation of the Unstereotype Alliance. So he was really touched about how much that film could ignite on me. And when we celebrated 40 years of Alien, he gave me a poster of Sigourney Weaver contextualizing the Alien film. And this was a poster that it was in the back of his office for many, many, many years. So he was always working with Sigourney behind him.
Wow,
and of course, now I have Sigourney behind me in my office. Oh. And so it's been beautiful. So I think that is like 44 years ago. So I was around 10 years of age. Like that.
Wow. Wow.
Powerful moment. Yeah. And I mean, got guts. I've tried to watch Alien a few times, and the horror gets me. I can't do it. The face huggers is too much for me.
It is. Yeah, it is, isn't it? But imagine the role that she played. And apparently, Sigourney was not the one to be casted for that role. Apparently, he wanted to have a man.
Yeah.
And apparently, he interviewed many men. And eventually, she came and she did the test and she was chosen. And if it was not for that, perhaps I wouldn't be here. Mm.
So we'll see now how much that moment really did shape things for you, because you would face so many challenging moments in your career. And let's dive into it. You start your 35 years in Unilever at this moment in 1999 as a trainee. Tell us about how it begins. You go into sales at some point.
Yes.
And you have to spend 6 months in sales as part of your traineeship to try a few different departments about. But what was unique about you going into sales?
Yes, so it was 1989.
Ooh.
Yes, that I started. So yes, so 35 years ago.
Sorry, read it wrong.
Yeah, I went to Unilever because I wanted to go to the best marketing school. Before Unilever, I had my own business. I was selling lingerie, I was very successful. I was still at university. But, you know, I felt that I needed to learn much more to have a much bigger and much more successful business. And that's when I decided, I said, well, now that I'm finishing my course, maybe it would be much better for me to learn more about marketing before expanding my business. And for that, I went to the best marketing school. And in Brazil, there was no doubt that Unilever would be the case. And my plan was to come and stay at Unilever for 2-3 years maximum, learn everything about marketing and come back to my business and expand my business. But I joined Unilever. And when I joined Unilever, I was a trainee. And as a trainee, they invited us to do a kind of program where you go through different areas. And for the first time, they decided to send some women, in my case, I was the first, to the sales area. And And for me, it was a phenomenal experience because I think that if you wanted to be a good marketeer, being on the front line, understanding what your customers really need, what your consumers really need, is a fundamental element. So I spent 6-7 months in that area. And of course, that has helped me a lot to shape my understanding on how to do effective marketing.
And tell us, there's a great story here on how to handle difficult situations.
Yes.
It wasn't an easy ride in this this period in sales. What happened?
Well, there are many stories, but you know, since I was the first woman in sales, I think that the sales team were a little bit concerned about, okay, now we have women coming into our area, what that means. The clients as well say, wow, now you have women as sales people. So there was a little bit of a stereotype that women could not do sales. But you know, to make long story short, I think that women have different fortes, different areas, and we know how to deal with situations in different ways. And in my case, I don't want to get into the specifics, but in my case, I'm always trying to find the most inclusive way to find a solution. So always trying to find a common ground, a way that we can communicate, a way that we can identify something that the both sides want. And that was the case when I was working in sales. That was the case when I became the first director, the first vice president, the first EVP. So the first woman in many different situations. But I think that more iconic, the most iconic moment was really when I became the vice president of Unilever Brazil. And that was in the year 2000.
We'll try and do it in chronological order.
So then you get to a place where there's a big hire going on.
Yes.
And as your boss at the time,
yes,
there's a need of hiring 80 people.
Yes.
And within that, there was a small percentage of women. How did that play out for you in that time?
You are talking about when I joined Unilever, or you're talking a hypothetical example?
There was a story you told us when you spoke to the president of Unilever Brazil.
Yeah, that was when I joined Unilever. That's exactly okay. When I joined Unilever.
Oh, this is when you were trainee?
Yeah, that's when I was trainee.
Oh,
yes,
wow.
Yes.
Do you want to share about that?
Yeah. So when I joined Unilever, there was, so they were hiring students for the trainee program, and majority of them were men. So I remember that coming into the first meeting where we have this big room full of students, and majority of them were men. And I look around and said, wow, yeah, they didn't do a good job in terms of having 50-50 or having a more balanced a representation here. And the president of Unilever Brazil at that time was talking, and I asked him, you know, don't you think that we are missing representation here?
Was this in a public forum, you asked him, or in private?
So that was, I think, was, you know, it was not a hostile conversation. That right. was a very... nice conversation, but it was just as a curiosity because he was there introducing the company and we were all there together. And he said, you know, basically we are representing, you know, Brazilian society. Brazilian society is like that. Majority of people in businesses are men, not women. So we are just, doing the same as everybody else. And for me, it was like, but you can do so much better than that. Mm. Why? Yeah, you are just following the pattern that exists today. And indeed, even today, yeah, many companies are still struggling to have 50-50 in terms of representation. But imagine 35 years ago in Brazil. And that was the provocation. So from the very beginning, I was very curious to understand why there was not better representation. And when I started, it was more about representation in terms of gender And when I started to evolve in my career, then I realized that actually we were missing out a representation in so many other dimensions, mm-hmm. especially in a country as Brazil that is super rich in terms of different cultures, mm-hmm. different races, different ethnicities, where, you know, the community of LGBTQI plus is so rich as well. So that, you know, I was missing that representation in the company. And as I moved along in my career, there are many things that I started to do to break focus on one unique group of characteristics and start including other characteristics in our, especially in our leadership.
Mm. And we continue your trailblazing through as being the first woman in many areas.
Yes.
On to the next moment.
You then get to a place where you're invited to be on the board.
Yeah, that was very interesting. When I was invited to be a part of the board of Unilever Brazil, that was in the year 2000. And my boss came to me and said, Aline, we need a vice president of marketing. And I invited Marcelo, I'm just saying a different name from the real name. Mm-hmm. We invited Marcelo, but Marcelo is going to move to France, so he's not going to be able to take this role. So he was our first candidate. Then, since he could not make it, we invited João. But João is going to move to a different area. He doesn't want to work in marketing anymore, so he's not going to be able to do this job. So then I thought of you. But I'm not so sure if you can make it.
Wow.
Yeah. So you are.
Yeah.
Yes. You're not the first candidate. You're not the second candidate. And I have doubts if you really are the third candidate. Would you be interested? And at that time, although I just had my first baby and I was, you know, struggling with, you know, motherhood and etc., I said, yes, of course, yeah, give it to me and we'll do my best. And if it works, fantastic. If it doesn't, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And he brought me to the board level. There was a floor that was the board. And he introduced me to this beautiful room. And at that time, we had rooms. Now, at Unilever, we all work in open floor. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very different story. But at that time, we had specific rooms for each of us. And they said, oh, thank you very much. This is lovely. This is incredible. Thank you. And by the way,
that was your office.
That was my own office. So it was a huge office, almost the size of this this room, with sofas, with meeting tables. It was incredible. And I said to him, that's fantastic. But where is the ladies' room? Where is the restroom? Mm-hmm. And then he said, I'm so sorry. Since you are the first woman to come to the board, yeah, I will have to talk to all the other vice presidents that now they have to share our male bathroom with you. So if you don't mind, you know, let me talk to them, yeah, and you can use our bathroom.
What a great solution.
Great solution. But at that time, there were this kind of, how do you say it in English? This urinals that are on the wall.
Urinals.
So I said, I don't think so. I don't think it's a good idea that I'm going to use your bathroom with urinals on the wall. Thank you very much. So as vice president of Unilever Brazil, my first decision is going to be to build the first female bathroom in the board floor. Mm. And he could not say no, so I did it. So it was built in a blink. And we built this beautiful bathroom in the way women like it, with full mirrors, hair dryer, everything we need. And the day that it was ready, my boss said, we are going to inaugurate it. I said, fantastic, let's inaugurate the bathroom. And to inaugurate the bathroom, he brought a plaque to put on the door. And the plaque was saying, Aline Santos. And I was like, what is this? And he said, well, this is your bathroom, Aline Santos. I said, no, this is the ladies' room. This is the restroom for women. I said, yeah, but you are the only woman in this floor. So, you know, that's your bathroom. And then I realized how much prejudice and how much conditioning they all had, that they didn't notice that for many, many, many years, there were like 10 secretaries, female secretaries, sitting on that floor.
Wow.
But they were not noticed. And actually, those ladies had to go to another floor every time that they wanted to go to the loo. And so I said to them, you know, it's amazing how biased and how blind you all are. Look at all those ladies, all the secretaries. So of course we changed, so it was a female bathroom, not Aline Santos' bathroom. And of course all the ladies sitting in that floor, they really loved the bathroom and used the bathroom, etc. Mm-hmm. But of course this was again 24 years ago, and so much has changed. Mm. And when I joined that board, there were many other transformations that were necessary. And I was always strategizing how I'm going to do it. Because I could come and sit in that board full of men who never had a woman sitting around them and start to, show all my colors and say, yeah, that's the way women do it. But I thought that there would be a more intelligent way of doing it. Mm. And I call that the porridge strategy.
Mm. Okay,
and I'm just adapting the strategy to the UK reality, because in Brazil we don't eat porridge, but we eat soup. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's the same thing.
What's the name for porridge in America? It's not porridge.
Oatmeal.
For the American audience.
So
yes.
It's the same. So oatmeal, soup, porridge. Same strategy. Mm-hmm. And the strategy of eating soup, oatmeal, or porridge is that you have to eat it, eating from the borders, yeah? Mm-hmm. Because if you put your spoon in the middle of the porridge and then put it in your mouth, you are going to burn your tongue, right? Mm-hmm. So that's exactly what I thought. If I start showing all my crazy ideas and a different style, shocking all of them, I think I'm going to burn my tongue and I'm going to burn my bridges with all these people. Mm. So I said, I'm going to go slowly but surely, trying to understand what are the dynamics of this group, what they value, what is important for them, what are the best way that I can contribute, mm-hmm. but in a way that is not shocking, in a way that is contributing, is adding value. It's not polarizing them. Mm. And with that, I started to gain something that is the most important thing when you join a new group, which is trust. And when you got trust and people see that you can truly contribute, people can start really open up and be more, curious to different points of view, more open to a more polarized discussion, and so on and so forth. So when I started having this very trustworthy relationship with them, that they understood that I could play in their dynamic, in their game, but also I could add value, they started to open much more space for me to be really who I am and really bring many more changes. But to give you an idea, when I started, I really wanted to be almost part of that group of wolves. How do you call group of wolves?
Pack of wolves.
Yeah. So at that time, I started to buy suits. I love suits, but my suits at that time, they were blue like yours or black like yours. I was using this shoulder pads, just to look a little bit more formal and a little bit more more. Yes. Mm, yeah. And also I was wearing some glasses, but the glasses didn't have any lenses, but just to look a little bit more intellectual, more serious. and the piece of resistance was actually wearing my husband's perfume. So, wow. It was all kind of strategized in order that they could feel at ease with me. And of course, in due time, I became what I am, and I have a great relationship even with that board that is 24 years ago. I still have many of them as friends, and the CEO at that time who hired me to that job is today one of my best friends and one of the most important people in my career. His name is Simon Clift, and I owe him so much. And he's still influencing me, influencing my husband, my kids. He's a big influence in my life.
Such a powerful story, because so many people would feel, understandably, like, I'm not going to change for these guys. Yeah, you know, I'm going to be who I am. I'm going to dress how I want. I'm going to wear what I want. I'm going to smell how I like. But I guess you sort of read the situation and thought, okay, for the outcome that I want, which is to gain trust and then influence this people, this is the path I need to take, and sort of put the ego aside and go, this is what I'm going to do. It's just so powerful.
Indeed. And I wouldn't say that this is the right strategy for everyone in every situation. Mm. I think you said it very well. I think it's understanding the context that you are working on. Mm. Yeah, that was 24 years in Brazil, in a board that never seen a woman in their lives. And they were all looking at me and say, is she going to work or not? Is that going to work or not? Mm. So I think that there are different moments. So, you know, fast forward 4 years ago when I was invited to be part of the board of IKEA, again, I was the first woman. They didn't have a woman in the Inter IKEA board. And, you know, there I didn't have to do the same kind of technique because the world has evolved. The context was different. IKEA is also a very open and inclusive culture. So there I could be Aline Santos in full from day one. And I said to them, if it works, because they also had doubts if it was going to work, because I was the first woman and the first person that was coming from outside IKEA to be part of the Inter IKEA board. So I said, if it works after 1 year, can you promise me that you're going to hire other women? Mm-hmm. And it has worked, and they have hired other women. So I'm very glad that the story there is also going to the right direction.
I love that. Yet again, coming in as the first woman and showing the results that can come from it.
Yes.
Which is really
and making powerful. Sure that doors open for more women. I think that is like really, really special to be able to do.
Yes.
So you have mentioned your husband. I'll hand to Ash for this part.
Yeah, so but at this time you're married, you have children, and then we get to a very sad day where you were just about to fly to Dubai. Something happened.
Yes. Well, first I have to say, you know, it's so interesting. I have followed so many business people, women, men, that I really admire, but it's so rare that they talk about their partners. It is so rare that they talk about their relationships. And for me, this is so important because your partner can be really a trampoline in your life, can really catapult you. If they truly have a love relationship, not a relationship of attachment, your partner can really be the one who is always, you know, making you fly. And that is the case that I have with my husband. He is a big trampoline in my life in so many ways. And we have a deep, loving relationship. And there was this moment that I was going to travel to Dubai. I always traveled a lot, especially in the last 20 years, I've been traveling a lot. So he was very used that I was traveling, my kids as well. So I was all packed to go to Dubai. And here he comes, he was at the gym, and he comes and say, I'm not feeling very well. I'm going to go to the hospital. And I was like, really? Are you feeling that bad that you need to go to the hospital? And he said, yes, I have a very strong stomachache. And the personal trainer is saying that I should go to the hospital. And I was like, wow, this is very unusual. So I'm going to go to the hospital with you. And he said, no, you go to Dubai, and I phone you from the hospital just to tell you what it is. And I said, okay, but I will stay at home. I'm not going to go to the airport. I'll stay at home, you go to the hospital, and then you tell me. But he was not phoning me. He was not phoning me, and I was getting nervous, and I started to phone him, and he was not picking the phone. And then I was starting to get even more nervous. I thought he was going to the hospital with the personal trainer, but the personal trainer said, no, he went by himself. So I was getting very, very nervous, and eventually he picked up the phone. And I said, wow, where are you? How are you? And he said, no, I'm at the hospital. And I said, how are you? And he said, no, I'm fine. I'm totally fine. Just go to Dubai. And I heard a voice saying, tell her the truth. And I said, who is next to you? And said, no, it's the nurse. And the nurse repeated, tell her the truth. And I said, what is the truth? And he said, well, I'm having a heart attack.
Oh, wow.
And I was, what? What? A heart attack? And he said, yes, but I've been treated, I'm being cared. Go to Dubai. And said, you mad? So I went like a crazy woman to this hospital that was far from my home. There was a lot of traffic. You can imagine the sort of situation. I arrived at the hospital and I started to ask his name. And then someone came to me and said, oh, are you the wife? I said, yes. And she gives me a plastic bag with his clothes. And she says, sorry, but he's not here anymore. And I was like, what? And I fainted on the floor, because my understanding was that she was saying to me, he died. Yeah, and here are his clothes. So I was, you know, on the floor. There was another doctor who came to me and said, no, you misunderstood her. She just meant that he is in another floor of the hospital. And
Not the best delivery of that news.
He's having an operation. He's putting some stents. So be calm. Everything's going to be fine.
But and for those moments, you thought you'd lost your husband.
Mm. It was horrendous. And those moments... That moment, from listening to that nurse till 6 months later, the fear that I never had kicked on me, the fear of losing this man that is so, how I'm going to cry, so important in my life. And he survived. He survived. He's wonderful. He's healthy. He's much healthier than me. But the fear of losing someone like him was incredibly strong and iconic and intense and horrifying. And although he was all right just after the operation, this operation is a quite simple operation these days to put an extent. Stent, it says in English, yes. Mm. But yet, you know, that remained with me for 6 months. That was a very intense experience.
What were the kind of thoughts and feelings at that time?
It's just the thought of not having him in my life anymore. That was terrifying, and that was something that I could never envisage. He was super young. He was 48 years old. So, you know, I could never envisage that, I would have a husband that was going to have a heart attack. He was super healthy, doing marathons, doing all this kind of things. And that gave all of us this sense of the importance of living the moment, being present, and not taking anything for granted. And the silver lining of this story is that because of that, this changed a lot, the way he was looking at his career. He was a very successful businessman as well, leading his family's businesses in Brazil, but he was extremely stressed, working many, many hours. And that realization gave us the opportunity to rethink our lives and to rethink what we wanted to do. And thanks to that event, we decided to change everything. And we decided to move from Brazil to the UK and to live in London. And that was in 2017 when we moved. And we moved, and it was like something really radical changed my life, his life, the life of my kids. So much that, we loved so much being here in the UK, and the UK, specifically London, is a city that opened up so many new opportunities for the entire family. So I'm so grateful to be here, and so grateful to the heart attack as well, because if that didn't happen, most likely we would be still living in Brazil, which was wonderful. But I think that living here opened up many new dimensions for all of us.
And there's something you shared with us about how you commemorate your marriage every 5 years. Tell us a bit about this.
Yeah. It's a very deep, loving relationship. It's a relationship that really requires celebration. And so what we do is that every 5 years we get married again. And we try to do this in the most interesting and funny way so that people can enjoy with us. It's also an excuse to have the whole family together and the most closest friends. So every 5 years we do a funny wedding. So we had a wedding inspired with the movie Mamma Mia. So we had a wedding in Greece and we had everything that the Mamma Mia wedding had, the donkey, the church, the priest, everything, the dance, everything. It's a super fun. We had another wedding that was inspired by 1001 Nights. So we had a wedding in Marrakesh where we had a wedding ceremony made by the Berber community. So, you know, every 5 years we do something crazy and wonderful. And we just cherish this moment with our beloved ones and inspire them for a loving relationship. Because, you know, again, you cannot take life for granted and celebrating people that you love, inspiring others to love is something that is a very important part of our lives.
What advice do you have for keeping a long, loving relationship?
Oh, I think that... authenticity is very important. We never go to sleep without having a conversation. If there was a problem, we never go to sleep in a way that he is upset with me or I'm upset with him. We always have a very healthy dialogue about everything. Yeah, we are a wife and a husband, but we are also amazing friends as well. I think that there is a lot of love without attachment as well. I think he gives me a lot of space to be who I am. He gives me a lot of space in my career, for instance. There has never been a moment where he was saying, oh, you shouldn't travel that much. I'm here alone, you know, who is taking care of the house, of the kids. Never like that. So he gave me this space, yeah, to do the things that I wanted to do, to be who I wanted to be, to explore different things. And that was showing how much deep was the love, and it was not based on attachment. I think that we divide our responsibilities. We work like a system. We are like a system. We are like one. And we almost can read each other's mind all the time and understand what's going on. And that chemistry is very genuine. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult to keep a relationship when there is no chemistry, when the chemistry is forced, is arranged, it's not genuine. So I think that this is very critical. Being honest to each other, also I think investing time to be together, investing time to have special moments together. This wedding, for instance, every 5 years, it requires preparation. It requires a lot of work. But, you know, we cherish this together. We do it together. We enjoy this together. Yeah. So I've been very fortunate to have a good relationship with the companies that I work, be it on the non-executive board or with Unilever, that I could always accommodate this. So I'm someone that always take holidays. I think having a healthy personal life is fundamental for your creativity at work, for what you do, to become a better leader, to be a more inspiring leader. You know, I think that is very important when you are in a leadership role, that whoever interacts with you, they have an interaction with you and they come out of that interaction with much more energy than the energy that they start the day. So how can you inspire people? How can you motivate people? And you can only do that if at a personal level you feel fulfilled, you feel that you're in a good space. So I think it's very important to invest time in your personal life, invest time in your relationships. Sometimes it's not relationships like partners, but relationships like, you know, with friends, with family. But more importantly, is the relationship that you have with yourself. Mm-hmm. And knowing yourself you know, loving who you are, I think is a very, very critical step to be in love with someone else and to have a long relationship with someone else.
How do you love yourself? What's your advice on that? How does someone go from maybe not loving themselves enough to doing that more?
I think that different people use different ways. But is a self-discovery way. I think that when you go through a self-discovery journey, and people use different techniques to go to a self-discovery journey, you start to realize who you are, and you start to realize that, of course, you're not perfect. Nobody is. But you start to laugh about your faults. You start to laugh about the things that you don't think that are all right. You start to laugh when you make a mistake and then you make the same mistake again. Yeah, of course, we wanted to grow. Of course, we wanted to evolve. But sometimes it takes time. So taking it easy, taking it with a light heart, I think is important. And realizing that actually we are so much more than what we think we are. It's exactly like Sigourney giving me a kick and say, you can be whoever you want to be. Mm-hmm. And in this self-discovery journey, I think that everyone will discover that actually we can be so much more.
Very powerful. Thank you for sharing. You would go from trainee in 1989 at Unilever to global senior vice president of laundry between the years of 2011 to 2015, and then Executive Vice President of Global Marketing and Chief Diversity Inclusion Officer, and then your position today, June 2021, where you become Chief Brand Officer and Chief Equity Diversity Inclusion Officer. What do you think, looking back, how have you been a great person in a leadership role in Unilever to help you progress in your career? So other people who maybe they're on the board, or maybe they're very senior, and what's your, looking back, advice on how you've got to where you are?
What I noticed is that if you think about the corporate world, if you think about the business world, different leaders have different paths, and they have different traits, and they have different reasons why they got where they got. And I think it's important for each of us, again, in this self-discovery journey, to understand where we can make a difference. Where are the areas that we can excel? Of course, there's so much more we can do, but there are some areas that are more natural for us, that that come in a more intuitive way. Mm. And I think that for me, has always been that immense curiosity that I have about people, about the world, about everything. So curiosity was a big lever for me to discover things. Intuition, I use my intuition a lot. I think it's very under-evaluated, especially in the world of data today. I think intuition is under-leveraged, but I used a lot of intuition and still do in my life. But perhaps the most important thing for me has been creativity, how to leverage my creativity. And there is a very specific filter in the way I think about creativity in my career, which has always been, how can I break the mold? How can I break the box? How can I do something that is really surprising that nobody thought before? And with that, how can I create better businesses, but also some goodness? And that has been the kind of thin line that I'm always trying to find. Yeah, mm-hmm. This kind of sweet spot between breaking the rules, but at the same time doing something great, yeah, for the business and for society.
Okay. Well, there's a great example of that. Yes. We had some questions on.
Yeah.
And that is, so breaking the mold and doing something different. There was a time when you were in charge of the Vaseline account.
Yes.
And you chose to do something really bold.
Yes.
To make a difference with that brand and for people of Brazil at the time.
Yes.
Please tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So at that time, that was in the 90s. I was responsible for this brand, Vaseline Intensive Care. In Brazil, it's called Vazenol. It's the same brand as American brand. And the brand was very small at that time, only 4% market share. Mm. So it was not very successful. And they said, Aline, now you take care of this brand, do something about it. And I was looking at the brand and the style and the communication, and it was not really communicating with Brazilian people. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking, how can we make something that is genuine to Brazilian consumers? Mm-hmm. And if you come to Brazil, you see that we have 62 different skin tones. We have, everyone can be Brazilian. Everyone can be Brazilian. But 60% of the population in Brazil are people of color. And they were completely and utterly neglected. And when we think about skincare, yeah, people of color, they really, really care about their skin. And they really wanted to have something that is deeper in terms of moisturization so that, you know, it doesn't have that aspect of dryness. And there was nothing in the Brazilian market for those consumers. So I said to the R&D community, I wanted to create a formulation that is specifically developed for people of color in Brazil. And the R&D team said, amazing, let's do it. And we spent almost 2 years creating a very rich formulation, a formulation that the target audience really enjoyed, that was profound, that was good, but at the same time not sticky, all the things that you would expect. With that, I said, we need to create an advertising. And for the advertising, I said, I would like to have three women of color, but with three different skin tones, yeah, and show the beauty of the different tones. And I started to develop the advertising with Macken Harrison at the time. They were super excited. We created a beautiful film at that time where we had these three women of color, different tones, but they were the protagonists of the advertising. And it was the first time in Brazil that we had an ad where women of color were protagonists. So it was quite an iconic moment. So I came to the launch of the product in front of many customers of Unilever, and I was on stage and I was so proud because I felt that that was so meaningful, that was going to be so iconic for the Brazilian market. And I presented with so much confidence. But the audience looked at me and they didn't applaud. They didn't do anything.
Silence.
Silence. And I was like, wow, what that means. And then I stepped back from the stage and I was sitting with a round table full of customers. And one of the customers, a big customer in Brazil, came to me and said, Aline, you've done so many wonderful innovations for Unilever, so many amazing advertising, but this one, you got it completely wrong. Uh-huh. And I said, why? And he said, well, because, you know, this is not the kind of target audience. This is not right. This is not right for this brand. This target audience is not the target audience of my brand or the customer brand, my retail. And I was like, oh, my God. Yeah, I was really taming myself not to respond in a very aggressive way, in a very emotional way. And I said to him, well, if you believe that I've done great things before, just buy the product for 1 month. Allow the advertising to go in there and see what happens. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But if it works, and he was struggling with that, but he decided to do that. And it was a big retailer, so it was an important point to have the brand in that retailer. And guess what? Yeah, we put the ad on air. We put the product on shelf, and it was an instant success. Mm. because for the first time in Brazil, there was the recognition that the majority of the population was the target audience of that product, was the target audience that was portrayed and represented in advertising. And of course, that created a big stir, and people were extremely moved about that.
That was the first time that happened in Brazil.
That was the first time that happened in Brazil, and that was in the 90s. And we received lots of correspondence, letters, because at that time, again, we didn't have CRM, we didn't have many things. And in the letters, I think that the letter that most touched me was a letter of a mother saying that her daughter, who had curly hair and dark skin, for the first time, went into TV and touched the TV and said, Mom, we are here. And so that was very touching for me. And again, it's like the alien moment, yeah, for someone seeing themselves, being represented, open possibilities, breaking stereotypes. Of course, when I created that in the 90s, I didn't have this articulation that I have today. Everything was much more intuitive. It was much more natural and organic. Now I can do a post-rationalization of the past.
Does it get you emotional thinking about like how you can change a person's life and like how much of an impact you can have on people by creating things like this?
Yeah, that's what moves me. That's what moves me because, you know, if you think about, I have two jobs. I have equity, diversity, and inclusion, and I have marketing. The sweet spot between these two jobs is my capacity to change behavior. It's my learning, my capabilities, everything that I've learned in marketing and how I can apply this on diversity and inclusion. And why I want to change behavior, I just want to change behavior in order that we can become a more inclusive nation. Yeah, if you think, you know, if someone in the space is looking at us, they look at us as one group of people. Yeah, but we find so many reasons to create divides, so many walls that we build without any necessity. And so for me, the motivation comes from breaking those walls, breaking those barriers, putting stereotypes aside and humanity first. And every time there is an opportunity, that's what I'm trying to do, be it inside the company, be it on advertising, be it on innovation.
So if I'm someone watching or listening to this now, and I want to make a positive impact in the world through my organization, whatever that might be, it could be in marketing, could be something completely different, and they have an idea they know would work really well. What's your advice on how to get those ideas to happen against people who may not see things the way that you do? Like, how do you do it?
Well, I think that the first thing I would say is, in my experience, I'm not saying that my experience is the best experience, but in my case, in my experience, trying to find common ground is extremely important. Sometimes I meet people that I completely agree with the convictions, philosophy of inclusivity, etc. But the style is a little bit different from mine because some people wanted to clash, wanted to be angry and to fight and to be loud. And sometimes that works. It's not my style. And in the business world, I felt and I experienced many people failing because of that style. And I think it's much smarter for you to understand again the landscape, understand the dynamics, understand what's important for the other person so that you can find a hook that you can introduce your idea, your program, and so on and so forth. Because sometimes we are so convinced about what we believe that we don't hear the other. We don't hear what the other organization, people, group want to do. Therefore, there's no connection, there's no conversation. And so I think it's very important also to have your ears open. And sometimes it's also very important for you to review your convictions because sometimes you don't know the whole truth. You don't know the whole story. You are missing an important part. So keeping alert, you alert all the time about understanding all the pieces is important. Having compassion, not empathy, but compassion to others, I think is very critical as well. So my suggestion is always listen more than you say. Find the common ground. Find a constructive, positive way to build your story or your program. And the other piece is sometimes we don't have patience anymore because we are seeing so many things going wrong and you wanted to fix things tomorrow. But people are in a different pace and you have to recognize that. So sometimes what is smart is to put an objective in a point in the future, not tomorrow, in the future, and have that common ground in the future, not tomorrow. So I would like you to change your point of view about this and this and that. But I'm not saying for you to do this tomorrow. I'm talking about the future. Let's agree about a vision, a common vision in the future. And when you start removing this pressure of it has to be tomorrow, people start to open their hearts and they started to open to you and they started to have a conversation and put a plan in the future. And when you blink, that future is much closer because people also want that vision to come closer. So these are some of the techniques, but there are many groups that can help companies and brands to advance and accelerate this journey. And that's why I'm so proud of what we launched in 2017 with the Unstereotype Alliance and all the companies that are part of it now.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the Unstereotype Alliance.
Let us know what it's all about.
So why does it exist? What was the reason it's here?
So the alliance started in 2017, but before 2017, in 2016. We were doing at Unilever a big piece of consumer understanding, and we found out that majority of our consumers were not engaging with our advertising anymore. There was an alarming group of women, especially, that were saying, I don't engage with this anymore. And I was shocked to see that because we were supposed to understand consumers so well. FMCG company, amazing brands, 400 brands, so successful. Well, and when we start to dig to understand why consumers were saying that, we realized that consumers were not seeing themselves represented in advertising anymore. They were not seeing society represented in advertising anymore. They were not recognizing anything that was really going on in the world in the advertising. And these were, from simple things like where we are doing an advertisement for Knorr, the cooking cubes, having a woman, the old mama cooking, why it has to be the woman that is cooking, Everybody has a passion for food. Everybody has a passion, not everybody, but many people have a passion for cooking. Why we have to have a woman cooking? Why has to be always a woman? So simple things like that, or even more sophisticated things. But so that was calling our attention, saying, wow, yeah, indeed. And we started to review our advertising, and our advertising was full of stereotypes. And actually, then we started to review the advertising of the industry. And we said, wow, it's not only us, everybody is just, repeating again and again and again the same stereotypes about gender, sexual orientation, race and ethnicity, people with disabilities. Oh, they don't exist in advertising. So we realized that, we are missing a lot. It looks like that we are prehistorical. Everything evolved, but not advertising. And we started to think, why is that? And partially it's because we are lazy as marketeers and lazy as the industry as well. And, we just repeat the briefs. We just repeat the kind of stereotypes, because stereotypes are helpful to tell a story, because with a stereotype, people can recognize things. So we said we cannot be lazy anymore. We have to think about how we are writing briefs, how we are telling the story. Is this casting right? Is the role being well portrayed by this gender, by this sex orientation, et cetera, et cetera? And we started to see that when we broke the stereotype and start to tell stories that were much more relevant and coherent with the life that we live today, people were turned on and they were engaging. And we had phenomenal results in terms of the perception of our brands, the intention of buying our brands. All the indicators were up in the chart. And I was so pleased with that. And we started to do more and more and more. And the evidence was coming and coming. So I came to my boss. At that time, my boss was Keith Wheat, the chief marketing officer for Unilever. And I said, Keith, look at these results. It's phenomenal. And I said, you know, imagine if other companies can do the same. Because, you know, we are Unilever. We are the second biggest advertiser in the world. But we are not, you know, the world. So it would be great if we gather all the biggest companies in the world who have the biggest budgets of advertising and talk to them about what we are witnessing here. And imagine if all of them start breaking stereotypes, how this is going to be great for society. And he didn't even blink. He said, you're right. Mm. But we had a problem. And the problem was nobody in the industry wanted to sit together, especially competitors. We never had the case of competitors sitting together around the same table. So it was very, very contentious. And then we said, okay, what if we have a third party helping us? And we started to think about that. And in the meantime, what started to happen were very important movements that really accelerate this need. So after we started with Unstereotype at Unilever, we had later on hashtag MeToo, mm-hmm. hashtag Time's Up, and so many other movements that really started to shake the whole industry. And people started to get nervous. And people started to be much more attentive to what they were doing. So that was very, very helpful for us because there was a need in the industry now that was evident for everyone. So we said the best thing that we can do is to call a neutral part like UN Women to convene this group of companies so that together we can create the Unstereotype Alliance. And with that, we talked to UN Women. UN Women has a long history with Unilever. United Nations has a very long history with Unilever. We've done so many programs and projects together. So there was a very trustworthy relationship still today. And we launched it in Cannes in 2017. And it was an incredible moment. It was an iconic moment. If you see the pictures of the people who were there, they had never, ever were sitting in the same room together. Mm. So the tension was so big that I could take a knife and cut the air. But they all agreed that as an industry, be it companies like Unilever or be it platforms like Meta, Google, etc., we all needed to do our part to break stereotypes and make the world a more inclusive world. And since then, we have now 250 companies more or less around the world working with us. And we have every year a summit that happens in the United Nations Assembly for 2024. We have the biggest room that we have in United Nations because so many people want to take part. And it's a fabulous and inspiring summit that everybody gets ideas, exchange ideas, learn from each other, and accelerate the journey of an unstereotypical world. Mm.
Very powerful.
Yeah, super powerful.
And we're all about unifying on this show. It's what we do. And so it's so beautiful to hear when people do put their competitive nature aside and go, what is the common values here and what can we work together on?
Yes.
And the world needs more of that. Definitely.
Indeed.
For sure.
So you spent a lot of time studying metaphysics. What initially drew you to that study? And how has your understanding of it evolved over time?
I think that what called my attention about metaphysics was the possibility of using metaphysics as a way to know more about myself. So the self-discovery journey that we talked before, as I said, there are many different ways that you can do that. But through metaphysics, I felt that was a way that resonated with me. and would really enable me to learn more about myself. And I think that what inspires me about metaphysics is there are so many things.
What is metaphysics for anybody who's wondering? What are you talking about? What's going on here?
Yeah, so it's everything that is not matter. Yeah, so it's above the matter. Yeah, so it is the science of consciousness, and
they describe it as a branch of philosophy. It's like
it is more the study of spirituality, not a religion. Religion is something that is man-made. It's something that has a kind of framework and guidelines, etc. In metaphysics, you don't have that. So, but it's very much related to spirituality, and I think that what attracted me was to see that there are some universal laws, there are some aspects of life that we never put attention, but when we start to understand energies, which is very much the subject of metaphysics, everything starts to make sense. And I recognize many patterns in my life with the theories of metaphysics, without knowing that they were universal laws of metaphysics. And I think that for me, the biggest transformation that I've been seeing in myself since I started studying metaphysics was a transformation of starting to get a much higher level of self-mastery, meaning being much more grounded, being much more in control of myself, in control of my emotions, in control of my thoughts. Every thought has an energy, and how you react to that is something that I've been learning with metaphysics, to react in a way that is much more positive for me. It's much more enriching gives me much more opportunities to grow. I understood that actually we can have a fantastic and happy life, but what we are really here for is to evolve, is to grow. And through metaphysics, I've been learning a lot. I've been learning a lot how to evolve myself, how to be open, to learn more, even more, to really expand my life in different different ways and in different dimensions. I'm trying to simplify metaphysics in a simple language, but I think that the way I've seen practical help from metaphysics is how to react to things that happen around me, because things are going to happen, and every time we fight with reality, we lose. So it's important to understand what is reality. But how you react to the reality is something that you can choose. It's something that you can learn. And it's something that you can have more self-mastery, not to get despair, not to get too emotional, not to get into drama, or even worse, to get into the victim mode.
What's that?
Well, sometimes, especially in businesses, there are so many moments that something happened in the business and you think it's unfair. Oh, I'm such a victim. Look at that. He did that. And that is so unfair. Why he did that to me? Oh, he shouldn't be doing that to me. This is a kind of occurrence that is so common. Yeah, we see that every day. It's not only in businesses, in personal life as well. Oh, my boyfriend, he broke with me. Oh, he's so unfair. Why did this happen? I'm such a victim. No. So what we've learned is how much being a victim is a condition that we've learned over the years, since we, kids, how society conditioned this into us, and how disempowering it is. So I've learned how much is important for you to be very sensitive and attentive to how your thoughts provoke emotions in you. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts have different energies. Your thoughts can really be thoughts that are life-giving, but some thoughts can be life-destroying. Sometimes you're having a great day, but there is a thought that comes to your mind and you say, oh my gosh, destroyed my day. It's just a thought, but you allow that thought to destroy your day. So with metaphysics, you learn about all these forces. You learn about energies. You learn about your emotions. There is one interesting author who has a book called Power versus Force, and it's a scientific book. And there, what they've done, they measure the vibration of the different emotions that we have. And it's very clear that some vibrations are really in detrimental of our health and in detrimental of our life forces. And in the studies that I do, you know, I learn how to pivot from that lower vibration to a higher vibration sentiment. But this is a long story for another podcast where I can give you more. I'm trying to be succinct and just give you the top level of what metaphysics is helping me with.
Do you believe in God or a God?
I do. I think that some people call it God, some people call it Source. Mm. And I know that, especially in the UK, this is not a conversation that people like to have, but I do.
Oh, I want to know more now. Can you, for someone who maybe they have lived a period of their life that was, they were in a form of religion, maybe they no longer have that, but they know there's something more out there, but they're not sure what. Do you have any advice, or how does someone manage that or deal with that? My
experience is in my class, I have so many amazing colleagues, and the students are in all sorts of fields of businesses, all the most famous companies, very different people that have never worked in their lives. So I think that all of them have in common this curiosity of understanding more what is beyond, understanding spirituality, understanding that we are all, we have a soul. And many of them, they had to go through something very difficult in their lives. And because of that moment of difficulty, that was the moment that opened the door for this kind of search for metaphysics or for spirituality. So I noticed that for many people, they have to go through this painful moment in life to open up their hearts for this kind of knowledge. But not everybody, but I noticed that is a trace that that I noticed in many people, and many people that were completely skeptical and they didn't want to have anything to do with this.
It's unusual to have this kind of conversation in a business chat, right? In a business conversational context. Yeah. For example, if we were sitting on stage at Cannes and it was the metaphysics session.
Yeah.
People might think that's a bit odd.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we all need that, right? Mm. If you look at the state of the world today, we are not doing pretty things, are we? And so we need to find a different way. I think that there is a question about how we should lead businesses, what businesses really mean in a world that we live today, and how businesses can contribute. And why am I saying business? Because I think that businesses, they have the resources, they have the capabilities, they have the people. So I think it's a phenomenal force in the world. And if businesses can be more advanced in terms of how they lead, what they do, what is really success for business, I think this can be the biggest lever and accelerator for a better world. Of course, there are many other parts. Yeah, not everything are businesses, but I think businesses are the strongest lever. Of course, we have to work together with the government. We have to work together with NGOs. We all have to work together. But businesses, I think, can make the biggest impact. So having a vision of leadership that is more benevolent, that is more unifying, that is more inclusive, I think is going to be the next leap.
Very powerful. And I think there is a link between We had a conversation, an episode came out recently with a guy called Scott McDonald, who's CEO of the British Council and was CEO of Oliver Wyman, one of the biggest management consultancy firms. And he said that in the world of consulting, what they do really well that maybe other industries don't do well is, or as much, is they really invest in skills and training, especially also the soft skills as well as the hard skills, those traditional words. And the ROI on that, he said, for business is huge. And that's really what you could relate what we're talking about now to in terms of working on yourself as the soft skills.
Yes.
And the if we put it in a business case, the ROI on developing your staff's soft skills or developing your staff's ability to know themselves and learn more about themselves is really high.
No doubt about that. And in Unilever for many years, in terms of the standards of leadership, we had a group of standards of leadership that we called Inner Game, and another set of indicators that were called Outer Game. So Unilever saying you have to work in your inner game and you have to work in your outer game. So inner game is about self-mastery. So how you're going to master yourself, control yourself, make sure that you are at your best most of the time. There is another course that we've done as well that I think it was quite a breakthrough as well. When we are studying leadership, there are so many bestsellers and the topics are so much well known, but nobody stops to teach you how to become an inclusive leader. And what we've done was to invest on the top 900 leaders to do an inclusive leadership course, to really unstereotype the way you should be as a leader. And there were 9 dimensions that we tested people to understand where they were with these 9 dimensions of inclusivity. And then people got the results and they were like, oh my gosh. Yeah, even myself, the head of ED&I, I thought that I was going to score so well. Yeah, no, in some dimensions, very low. Yeah. And that gives you a sense of how much more you need to do. And in this training, of course, we give the tools, we give the indication of what you need to do to improve your leadership skills to become a more inclusive leader. But inclusive leadership should be part of any Harvard management course. I'm not sure if it is today. It should be part of any big company leadership development. And I think it is becoming. It is becoming. It's not yet there. It's not yet the pattern, but it is becoming. And I'm happy that at Unilever we're already there.
I think I've got a question. If you could bring all of the leaders within the industry together, what do you think is the most important thing to discuss?
I think the most important thing to discuss is what success means in the world that we live today. Mm. I think that we still have an old paradigm of success. Mm. I think that our paradigm is still only based on P&L and growth. And I think this is very important, but I think there are other dimensions that need to be more elevated.
Well, good. That is the story of how you became Chief Brand Officer and Chief Equity, Diversity, Inclusion Officer at Unilever.
Thank you. Thank you.
We have a final poem for you. Has been writing during this interview. Oh, yeah.
What a talent to be writing while
That's
talking.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Love, love, love. Fertile soil for a unique story to flourish. A young Eline resetting a paradigm in her mind to take a path that required true courage. From negative to a positive, creating rapport and friendships through building true connections. To living life without any fear, allowing you to grow boldly in all directions. The celebration of love for family, friends, and for yourself. A way to traverse your own self journey to develop your own personal sense of wealth. Levering intuition and creativity to break barriers, stereotypes, and walls. What a leader so led by purpose, sharing many examples of how bold choices can benefit all. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. So beautiful. So beautiful. You're going to share this, right?
Of course.
Wonderful.